Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bylaw 241, and it's October 2nd. And we're going to continue on with cell respiration and metabolism. Maybe we'll finish today. I hope we'll finish today. How's that in the back? Good. I can hear what's going on. Let's take a look at the schedule. So today's the 2nd. Indeed it is. This is our last lecture in Chapter 5, Cell Respiration. And then next week we're going to start nervous system, and we got 3 lectures on that. That might be the longest part of the class in terms of chapter review. And that's all in Chapter 7. And then we're going to look at autonomic nervous system, and then that's it for exam number 2. All right, so does anybody have a question regarding the schedule? Everybody pretty much in tune? What's going on right there? Do we have any news or announcements from SI? Nope, you're good? You all are good? All right. Okay, so let's get started. We're talking about metabolism. What the heck is metabolism? What's a good way to think of metabolism? Yeah, it's all like biochemical reactions that are taking place in your body at one time. Right? There's hundreds or thousands of reactions. And remember, we can break metabolism down into 2 main kinds of metabolism, or we can subdivide metabolism down into 2 categories. That's maybe a better way to say it. We can think of a part of metabolism where large molecules are broken down, and the second way is when we have small molecules that are joined together, 2 different ways. So what do we call it when we start with a large molecule, end up with smaller ones? We break things down. That's catabolism, and typically are those exergonic or endergonic reactions. Exergonic, yeah, when we break bonds, we release energy. All right, so that's catabolism, and what is it when we build large molecules from smaller ones? What do we call that? That's anabolism. All right, so you need some pieces to be put together, but you also need something else to put those pieces together. You need energy. Yeah, you need energy. So those are what we call endergonic reactions. Okay. So here's that slide, this overall slide that I want you to know about cell metabolism. And remember, I see 4 different compartments on this slide. We have a compartment that is made up of your digestive tract or liver. Then we have blood. Then we have things inside the cell, but not inside an organelle. This is in the cytosol. And then the very last row is a diagram of what's happening inside where? Inside. So we got digestive tract, blood, cytosol, and inside mitochondria, right? So inside mitochondria, we have a number of different reactions. Last time we talked about glycolysis. And then, of course, you're familiar with what glycolysis means. It's just a breaking down of glucose, right? We snip that molecule in 2. We end up with 2 pyruvic acids. And a good way to remember that is glucose has how many carbon atoms? 6. And pyruvate has, if we split glucose exactly in half, it's going to have 3, right? So you get 2 pyruvic acids. Maybe I asked you to draw that in, a 2 for this pyruvic acid. And what's happening in the cytosol does not require oxygen. So this just happens all the time, no matter what the conditions are. But if the cell is operating under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid cannot get into mitochondria. It has to take an alternative path. That alternative path is what we call anaerobic respiration. It gets converted into lactic acid. That's an oxidation reduction reaction. Lactic acid can leave the cell, go to the liver, right, and then the liver can make more glucose out of it. We call that the Cori cycle. The other thing that anaerobic respiration does, not only does it get rid of pyruvic acid that allows glycolysis to continue, but it also regenerates NAD+. NAD+ is necessary for glycolysis. Right, and glycolysis produces NADH. NADH will inhibit glycolysis, but NADH is used up when pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid, and that regenerates NAD+, so that glycolysis can keep operating. All right. Most important thing is not on this slide, and I want you to draw it in, and probably today is a good time to figure out what that thing is that's not on this slide. Yeah.
How does
So for instance, if it's a muscle, right, and that muscle is exercising very rapidly, there's not enough oxygen being delivered to that muscle, and when a muscle is contracted, blood can't even get into it, for instance. So there's no oxygen entering. So these cells then, since they don't have oxygen, we call that anaerobic. They become anaerobic. And glycolysis is not terribly sensitive to whether oxygen is present or not, but if pyruvic acid is present, that's going to force glycolysis to go in the reverse direction. So the cell has to do something with this pyruvic acid. It can't leave the cell all by itself. So there is an enzyme that converts pyruvic acid to lactic acid. It's an oxidation reduction reaction. The other nice thing, so pyruvic acid concentration decreases, and because of law of mass action, then glycolysis will go in the forward direction. The other thing that this LDH reaction does is that since it's oxidation reduction, it takes NADH, which is a reduced form of NAD, and it regenerates NAD+, which is the oxidized form, and that oxidized form of NAD is what glycolysis needs to go in the forward direction. So getting rid of pyruvic acid, regenerating NAD+, is a way to make sure that glycolysis still keeps going in the forward direction. Now, why are we interested in having glycolysis go in the forward direction? That's the thing that's not on this slide, the rationale that I want you to see. What are some of the products of glycolysis? Yeah, pyruvic acid, but more importantly, ATP. And you should be aware, how many ATP are produced for every glucose? There are two, right? So there are actually four, but to get glycolysis going, there's an activation energy barrier. It requires two ATP. So 4 minus 2 is 2. That's why we say 2. Okay. All right, so that's the beauty of this lactic acid pathway. Now, if there is oxygen present, pyruvic acid doesn't get converted into lactic acid, what happens to it? It enters this space down right over here. What is this last row? What is the space? This is the inside the mitochondria. So pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria, and there it is catabolized all the way down to CO2. And in so doing, right, that's a highly exergonic reaction. Mitochondria know how to use that energy that's being released to resynthesize ATP. And that's really what we're going to look at today. So all of these processes here happen under only aerobic conditions or when oxygen is present. So I could ask you, if you look at this last row right here, what part of the cell produces CO2? And remember, that's the molecule that we have to exhale. It can become toxic, right? It's a waste product of cellular respiration. What part of the cell produces CO2? Or a better way of asking that, what organelle produces CO2? It is right there. It is the mitochondria, right? So mitochondria produce CO2. And so these mitochondria also need oxygen. It consumes oxygen. So I see, when we get into the mitochondria, I see a little arrow right here, downward arrow. That's an important pathway. I want you to call that the preparatory reaction, right? This little downward arrow. And then I see a bunch of arrows in the circle, and the slide recognizes that, labels that. That's Krebs cycle. That's very nice. And then, okay, I see an arrow pointing over here to this really long arrow. This is what we call the electron transport chain. And what's being transported in the electron transport chain? Electrons. That's why we name it like that. And so what kinds of reactions do you know when electrons are transferred from one molecule to another? Oxidation reduction reactions. That's right. When a molecule receives electrons, what do we say happens to that molecule when it receives electrons? It's reduced. And when a molecule gives away electrons to another molecule, what happens to the first molecule? When it gives away electrons, it becomes oxidized. And remember, reduction reactions can only take place when there is an oxidation reaction. They have to go hand in hand. These electrons, so oxidation and reduction always work together. All right, so we want to start right here in this first little arrow inside the mitochondria. Right, and what did we call this first little arrow? Yeah, preparatory reaction. And why is it that pyruvic acid can enter a mitochondria? Why does pyruvate enter mitochondria to participate in this preparatory reaction? Or under what conditions? Under aerobic conditions. If oxygen is present, pyruvic acid can enter. So that takes us to the topic of aerobic respiration right here. This is where we left off last time. All right, so here is the preparatory reaction. This slide is not labeled preparatory reaction, but I think you should go ahead and label it. I think it will help your understanding. So aerobic respiration begins when pyruvic acid gets into the mitochondria. Remember, pyruvic acid is made by glycolysis. And inside the mitochondria, actually inside the matrix, remember where the matrix part of the mitochondria is? It's the innermost chamber. So it's got to go through the outer membrane. It's got to go through the inner membrane. Right? And here is pyruvic acid. And indeed, we see that it has three carbon atoms. So how many pyruvic acids are made from every glucose? Yeah, there are two. So this reaction will happen twice for every glucose molecule. Here is something called coenzyme A, which leads me to believe that this is maybe one of the first coenzymes that somebody studied, right? Instead of coenzyme 1, coenzyme 2, coenzyme A probably signifies for that first coenzyme that somebody studied at one point in time. All right, so inside the mitochondria, we have NAD+, and that gets converted into NADH. What's a better way of saying converted into NADH? NAD+ is what into NADH? It's reduced, yeah? So it accepts some high-energy electrons, and where does it get these high-energy electrons from? It gets it from pyruvic acid. So when coenzyme A binds to pyruvic acid, this carboxyl group is cleaved off, and that produces a CO2, which eventually, of course, we have to exhale from our body. And where does that take place? What organelle is producing the CO2 right here? Mitochondria. Yeah, mitochondria. All right, so we get some NADH, and then we get something called acetyl coenzyme A. Any type of carbon atom that has these two carbons right here is what we call an acetyl group, or if it's an acid, we would call it acetic acid, right? So acetyl. It always refers to two carbons. And here is another enzyme that's going to carry this acetyl group into the Krebs cycle. What do we call a big organic molecule that carries something from one place to another, from one set of metabolic reactions to another set of metabolic reactions? And in this particular case, it's going to carry something from glycolysis to the Krebs cycle. And it's a big organic molecule. That's what we call a coenzyme. And what do we call this thing? Its name is coenzyme, right? So that makes really beautiful, easy sense to make sense of that. All right, so this is the preparatory reaction. In order for the molecules or the carbons in glucose to get into the Krebs cycle, they have to go through this step first. They have to be joined to coenzyme A, and it does so by this carboxylation or decarboxylation step. It also produces NADH. All right, but before we leave this slide, what's contained in this NADH? It has been reduced. Electrons. Now, what kind of electrons? I want you to think of them as high-energy electrons, right? So NAD is carrying high-energy electrons. When it becomes reduced, it's NADH. And then mitochondria can do something with those high-energy electrons. And we're going to get to that in just a second after we look at the Krebs cycle. All right, so here we have pyruvic acid. Notice that it has three carbons. Enters the mitochondria. And what reaction is this right here that I'm circling? I see NAD+ going to NADH. A CO2 comes off, and that produces this acetyl-CoA. This is what we call the preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle, right? And it's exergonic. Some of that energy is used to carry these, to put high energy electrons into NAD+, making it NADH. All right, so coenzyme A takes this acetyl group, brings it over to the Krebs cycle, and in the Krebs cycle, there is a molecule that has four carbons, and it's joined with this acetyl group from the preparatory reaction, and so that will form a six-carbon molecule, right? 4 plus 2 is 6. I don't think I'm going to ask you to know the names of these intermediates, but you should know these are intermediates within the Krebs cycle. Not all of them are shown on this diagram. Right? So now we have a molecule with six carbons, and as the Krebs cycle turns, there are two more decarboxylation reactions, which produces what? A decarboxylation reaction produces a CO2. How many carbons entered Krebs cycle? There are two that entered, so as the intermediates proceed through the Krebs cycle, then these two carbon atoms are released as carbon dioxide. So how many carbon dioxides are released by the Krebs cycle for every pyruvic acid? There are two. Yeah, because the preparatory reaction produces one. All right. In the Krebs cycle, how many CO2s are produced for one glucose molecule? Because how many turns does the Krebs cycle move for every glucose? It moves twice, right? So there are four carbon dioxides produced by Krebs cycle for every glucose. How many carbon dioxide are produced by the preparatory reaction for every glucose? There are two. Yeah, so you should be able to multiply those things together in your mind. Okay. The other thing that you see right here very nicely is that what organelle produces CO2 that we have to exhale? It is mitochondria, right? That's some take home. All right, the Krebs cycle. We need to look in a little bit more detail, not too much, but just a little bit more detail. It produces one guanosine triphosphate. That's a high energy nucleotide. What's another high energy nucleotide that you're aware of? I know you know it. It is ATP, right? ATP is a high energy nucleotide, and GTP and ATP have the very similar energy. We could say it even has the same energy, so it's very easy to convert a GTP into an ATP. All right, so when you see GTP right here, that's specifically what's happening in the Krebs cycle, but you should think of it as Krebs cycle producing one ATP for every turn. So for how many GTPs are produced for every glucose molecule? How many times does Krebs cycle turn for glucose? Twice. For pyruvic acid, one time, but you get two pyruvic acids for every glucose. So for every glucose, you get these times two. But what we have right here is for every pyruvic acid molecule. All right, every turn produces three NADH as well, and one FADH2. All right, so what's the beauty of NADH and FADH2? What are they doing? They're accepting high energy electrons, and they're going to carry them to another metabolic reaction or metabolic pathway. And so these are what we call coenzymes as well. Right? So they're carrying high energy electrons. Another way to think of that is that they're carrying energy, just like ATP carries energy from one set of reactions to another. And where these electrons end up is something that we call the electron transport chain. And we're just going to say ETC from now on. And electron transport chain is a bunch of different kinds of molecules and proteins that are in the Christi membrane. Christi membrane is the deep membrane inside of a mitochondria that has all these folds on it, if you remember what a mitochondria looks like. Okay, so here is a really good diagram of the Krebs cycle. And I'm not going to ask you to memorize the names and enzymes that interconvert all of these different intermediates in this pathway, but I do want you to know some of the important bullet points. Namely, we talked about it, what gas is being produced by the Krebs cycle that we have to exhale from our body? Yeah, CO2. Do we see any CO2 being produced? Oh yeah, here's one right here, here's one right here. How many should be produced by one turn of the Krebs cycle? Two, because remember the preparatory reaction produces one, and that's before the diagram. All right, the preparatory reaction produces one, Krebs cycle two, that's three, that's how many carbons are in a pyruvic acid. So pyruvic acid is completely broken down. All right, in order for the Krebs cycle to work, we need NAD+, and then it accepts some high energy electrons and becomes NADH. And how many NADHs are produced for one turn of the Krebs cycle? Probably those of you that can see colors, it's really easy to see. It's what? One, two, three. Right? Does that stand out really nice and easy for you to appreciate? Good. All right. FADH probably has a little bit different color. And how many FADH2s are produced for every turn of the Krebs cycle? There's only one, right? And then the other thing that you notice on here is that there's ATP. And how many ATP are produced for every turn of the Krebs cycle? I just see one. But for every glucose molecule, how many ATPs are produced by the Krebs cycle? Two, because you got to multiply by two for glucose, right? Because there's two pyruvic acids in a glucose. All right, so those are the important bullet points to remember about the Krebs cycle. And the other thing that I want to talk about is that this ATP is being produced just by an enzymatic reaction. Right, when alpha-ketoglutarate gets converted into succinic acid, this ATP is produced. Right? We call that substrate-level phosphorylation because an inorganic phosphate is added to adenosine diphosphate. Substrate-level, sometimes we call that direct-level phosphorylation. Phosphorylation is just a way of making ATP. Of course, that's a very nice beneficial process, making ATP. Right. We looked at substrate level phosphorylation last time. I didn't mention it, but ATP that was just produced by some enzymatic reactions and did not involve transfer of electrons, didn't require oxidation reduction reactions. And what was that? Where did we see that substrate level phosphorylation? In glycolysis. Right. So these phosphorylations right here happen by substrate level or direct phosphorylation of ADP making ATP. Right, so that's important because there's another kind of phosphorylation that makes ATP, and that's what we call oxidative phosphorylation. Oxidative phosphorylation is the result of oxidation reduction reactions, which means what that involves the transfer of electrons, and any kind of process that uses the transfer of electrons is what we call oxidative phosphorylation. And I'll tell you why in just a second. All right, so ATP by the Krebs cycle, is that oxidative phosphorylation or substrate level phosphorylation? It is substrate or direct level, all right? And the same thing for glycolysis. It's direct or substrate level. It is not oxidative phosphorylation. All right, so that's pretty much it for the Krebs cycle. So now we have all these high-energy electrons in FADH2 and NADH, and these high-energy electrons can be used to make ATP. So let's see how that happens. That happens with what? The ETC, electron transport chain. And electron transport chain produces ATP via oxidative phosphorylation because it's just going to be the transfer of electrons. So here we are looking at some molecules in the Christi membrane, and some of these molecules you see are coenzyme Q, cytochrome B, cytochrome C1 and C, cytochrome A. These are just compounds. Here's cytochrome A3, right? You can see that these compounds have an iron molecule, and that iron molecule can change state from a plus 2 to a plus 3, right, when it loses an electron. So these compounds easily can accept an electron and can pass it on to another molecule. And as electrons flow from one molecule to another, what happens to the energy level of these electrons? Here is a graph. It decreases, right? So what kind of reaction is happening when electrons go from coenzyme Q, right, to cytochrome C and C1 and then finally down to cytochrome A? Okay, let me rephrase the question a little bit better. Is this an endergonic or exergonic reaction? If the reactants have more energy than the products, right, that means the products have less energy. Some of that energy is released by these chemical reactions. If it's released, it is exergonic. Yes, an exergonic reaction. All right, so if there is a step of exergonic reactions, what does your body usually like to do with exergonic reactions? What does it like to do with that energy? It is to make ATP out of it, right? So making ATP is endergonic, taking inorganic phosphate and ADP and making it go into ATP. That's an endergonic reaction. It needs energy from someplace, and it gets the energy as these electrons are transferred from one molecule to another in the electron transport chain. All right, so those electrons have to go someplace. So the electron transport chain is exergonic. That energy is used to make ATP. All right, so here we see NADH. It donates electrons. All right, so NADH becomes NAD. So what do we say NAD is? Is it oxidized or reduced? NAD plus is oxidized because it has given away electrons. It's given away electrons to FMN. So FMNH2 is what? Oxidized or reduced? It's reduced. All right, so again, this is what? An oxidation-reduction pair reaction. NADH can't be oxidized all by itself. Something has to accept those electrons, namely FMN, and when it does, it becomes reduced, right, when NAD plus is produced. So these electrons just flow from one molecule to another. That energy is used to make ATP. So for every NADH on this illustration right here, how many ATPs are produced? I see three. And that would be good for you to memorize, right? There are three. That's just the way it goes. And what about FADH2? Does it have the same energy as NADH? Because here is a graph of energy, right? What can you tell me about the energy level of electrons in FADH2 compared to NADH? Same energy? You're right. It's lower energy. So the electrons in FADH2 can't make 3 ATP. It can only make how many? 1, 2. Because it enters the electron transport chain, or those electrons from FADH2 enter the electron transport chain at a little bit lower energy. It can only make 2 ATP. All right, so that's really what I want you to know. Your book talks about it a little bit differently, but what I want you to memorize is that for every NADH, how many ATP are produced by ETC? You're going to say 3. And for FADH2, how many ATP are produced? And I just want you to say 2. Right? Those are under ideal conditions. Your body is never operating under absolutely ideal conditions. So under normal operating conditions, NADH doesn't make 3 exactly, it will make some fraction, maybe 2.5 or 2.75 or 2.25. And that's just too complicated for this class to really make sense and have that to be important. So just remember, for every NADH inside the mitochondria, it's 3, and for every FADH2 inside the mitochondria, it makes 2 ATP. Just nice round numbers, just like that. Okay. Now, how many ATP can be produced by NADH from the Krebs cycle for every pyruvic acid? Okay. Krebs cycle for every pyruvic acid makes how many NADHs? It makes 3 NADHs. And for every NADH in the mitochondria, how many ATP can be produced for every NADH? 3. All right, so what's the total number of ATP from the Krebs cycle via electron transport chain? It is 3 times 3, which is 9. All right, and those ATP made by electron transport chain are made by oxidative phosphorylation, not substrate level phosphorylation. And here's the reason why. In order for these oxidation reduction reactions to take place, those electrons have to hop from one molecule to another, to another, to another, and that last molecule can't store electrons. It would get filled up, right? And so those electrons in the cytochrome A have to go someplace, and where they go is into oxygen, right? So those electrons combine with oxygen and some protons that are in the matrix, and if we have these two protons and an oxygen molecule, what can that make? Water, right? And this is why we call this oxidative phosphorylation, because it can't happen unless those electrons can eventually end up in oxygen. So hence, this is oxidative phosphorylation. And in terms of ventilation, how do we get this oxygen? What do? Do we breathe in or breathe out? Yeah, we breathe in to get that oxygen into our body, then distribute it to mitochondria so they can make all this ATP for us. Via what? Oxidative phosphorylation. All right, so another good question would be, what molecule is last in this whole sequence here in the electron transport chain? What molecule is produced? Ah, here's oxygen. Is oxygen produced? No, because we need to inhale to get oxygen. Our body doesn't produce oxygen. Right? ETC produces what? What's the last molecule you see right here? Yeah, produces water. Okay, so again, it's pretty fascinating because not only is water the solvent that we're dissolved in, but it's a very important metabolite in the metabolism that keeps us alive. Right? So that's the final product of the electron transport chain. All right, so just remember, NADH produces 3, FADH produces only 2 because it enters the electron transport chain at different locations. And NADH, FADH2 carry high energy electrons from the Krebs cycle to ETC, and then they just jump from one molecule to another, and that produces ATP. But that doesn't really tell you how it's being produced. All right, I did talk about oxidative phosphorylation. Of course, this is exergonic, so I talked about this slide already. All right, so how is ATP produced when electrons go through the electron transport chain? And that's why we have this figure right here. This figure right here illustrates something we call the chemiosmotic theory. And I want to go over that right now. So if it's a theory, is it something that you can count on? Yes. Right? If it was a hypothesis, then maybe it's not true. But because it's a theory, it's something that you can count on. It's been looked at thousands of times, all kinds of researchers, physicians all over the world, and we know it to be something that functions inside mitochondria. Okay, so here is an exploded view of a mitochondria. We've zoomed way in. Remember, mitochondria has two membranes. Here is the outer membrane. And how do you recognize this to be a membrane? Because it is a phospholipid bilayer, right? So that's a membrane, that's the outer one. Then we have a space, and then we have another membrane. This is the inner mitochondrial membrane, but it's got even a better name. What's a better name for inner mitochondrial membrane? It is inner, yeah, endo would be a pretty good name, but it's even got a special name all by itself. It's called the Christi membrane, right? So this inner membrane is the Christi membrane. So here's the outer, here's the Christi membrane. The space between them is the intermembrane space, right? Inter means between these two. But deep to the Christi membrane, here is another space. This deep space inside a mitochondria is what we call the matrix. Okay, so here is the matrix. And this is where we find NADH, FADH2. The electron transport chain is dissolved in the Christi membrane, and I can see a whole bunch of different proteins and electron carriers in the membrane. So here is the accept, so this would be like FMN. It doesn't have to be labeled on the slide. It's not important for you to know that. But here is that first protein that can accept high energy electrons from NADH. Right, and when it does, what does that produce in terms of NAD? That regenerates NAD+, right? When NADH releases these electrons, they hop onto this protein right here, and then they move to the next molecule in ETC, and as these electrons move, they release energy. So this is an exergonic reaction. And when you have that energy released, this protein right here can take a proton that's in the matrix and put it into the intermembrane space. And this proton can go from low concentration to high concentration. So there's a high concentration of protons in this intermembrane space. What do we call that when something goes from low to high? Active transport, right? So that's not diffusion. That requires energy. Where does it get the energy? Where does this protein get the energy to pump protons into the intermembrane space from, these high energy electrons that are moving through these different molecules. All right, so then the electrons move from one to another. It goes into another second pump, and that energy is used to take protons from a low concentration in the matrix to a high concentration in the intermembrane space. And then finally, through a third pump, as these electrons move through it, takes protons low concentration in the matrix puts it into high concentration into intermembrane space. And then this third protein right here requires oxygen. Here I see oxygen, and it gets some protons, and that makes water. So that gets rid of all of these electrons. Otherwise, the electrons would back up, and electrons can't flow through electron transport chain. So now what do we have? We have a gradient of protons, right? High concentration of protons in the intermembrane space and low inside the matrix. And what could you tell me about those protons? What are they just dying to do? Move down their concentration gradient, right, and move back into the matrix, because a gradient is a source of energy. We looked at that. Remember, a battery is just a gradient of electrical charge. Here is a gradient of protons. And the last protein that we're going to look at is what we call a respiratory assembly. So here is an assembly of a whole bunch of different kinds of proteins. And this molecule is actually big enough that we can see it with an electron microscope, and it kind of looks like a lollipop. And it has a channel going through it, and that channel specifically can allow a proton to move through it from the intermembrane space to the matrix. Now, how can that happen? Does that require energy when protons go from high to low? Does that require energy? No, just by diffusion, they will move in that direction. Right? And so there's plenty of energy in these protons as they move through this respiratory assembly that ADP and inorganic phosphate can be combined to make ATP. So it uses energy in the gradient to make ATP as a result of electrons being accepted by this oxygen. So this ATP made by respiratory assemblies in the Christi membrane, we call this, what do we call this kind of phosphorylation? This is what we call oxidative phosphorylation, because it's dependent on the transfer of these electrons. So you could almost think of maybe this being a wire where electrons just flow right through this wire, but it's what? Just a number of different molecules and a different number of steps. All right, so this part of the respiratory assembly that can take ADP and inorganic phosphate and make ATP out of it, we call that an ATP synthase. Or an ATP synthetase, because it synthesizes what? ATP. All right, so ADP plus inorganic phosphate going to ATP, is that exorganic or endorganic? ADP to ATP is endorganic, requires energy. All right, and what about these protons that go from high concentration to low? Is that exorganic or endorganic? That's exorganic. Right? It just happens automatically. So that exergonic release of energy as protons move through this respiratory assembly can be used to run the endergonic reaction of making ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate. All right, so that's why it's really important to know some of that physical chemistry, like what is active transport, passive transport, what's diffusion, right? And how do molecules naturally like to move around. So this is what we call the chemiosmotic theory, and this is why a mitochondria is so complex, why it has a membrane inside of another membrane, right? Because it needs to separate these hydrogen ions or protons away from the matrix, right? And as they flow back down, that respiratory assembly can make ATP. All right, so that's pretty interesting how somebody even figured out how that happened. Okay, I think I talked about this slide already. What molecule is necessary to accept those electrons that are moving through the electron transport chain? Oxygen, that's right. And if oxygen is not there, the electrons can't go through these different pumps. You don't have that proton gradient. So if oxygen is not present, what happens to ATP that's produced by mitochondria? It stops, right? And highly organs that need a lot of energy, right, then they can't function and they'll die. Primarily, I think of three organs. Your brain, your heart, and your kidneys need a lot of ATP. And I think we talked about how much ATP you need the whole day. And if you take ATP away from your brain, what happens to your brain? 3 seconds, before you lose consciousness, right? 3 minutes and your brain is dead. Can't ever come back to life. Okay. All right, so here we see protons moving from the intermembrane space into the matrix when oxygen is present. And let's look at another circumstance that people are beginning to look at. Let's take oxygen away. Okay, when oxygen goes away, this electron transport chain stops working, and protons are not being put into the matrix via these pumps right here. But the mitochondria is very comfortable with having a high proton concentration in this intermembrane space. That's really what it lives to do. And when there's no oxygen present, it still wants to make this intermembrane space fairly highly concentrated in protons. Well, how can a mitochondria do that with no oxygen? It can make this respiratory assembly go in the reverse direction. All right, see this arrow right here? Erase this arrow tip and put it up over here, so this respiratory assembly will take protons that are in the matrix and put it in this intermembrane space. But when that happens, what else has to happen in reverse? ATP production. So when mitochondria become anaerobic, not only do they stop making ATP, they actually consume ATP. And so whenever we take blood supply away from an organ and take oxygen away from the mitochondria, then what do the mitochondria do? They don't become benign, they are actually harmful because they consume ATP to maintain this proton gradient. And so that would be, people are looking at that as a nice way to treat people that have strokes and heart attacks, because then we would like to stop mitochondria from using up ATP so that other processes inside those cells can use it instead. All right. ATP formation. There are two ways, right? Direct, we call that substrate level, versus oxidative phosphorylation. All right, so what metabolic pathway can make ATP by oxidative phosphorylation? It is the electron transport chain. All right, so I don't really like this slide because oxidative phosphorylation and Krebs cycle, that's not really true. Right? It is electron transport chain in the Christi membrane that can take ADP and make ATP out of it by the transfer of electrons. Direct level substrate, we saw that happening in glycolysis, and we saw that within one step of the Krebs cycle. Okay, so that is direct level as opposed to oxidative phosphorylation. Okay, when glucose is completely metabolized into carbon dioxide and water, right, I want you to realize that there are about 30 ATPs made that way when glucose is completely metabolized, about 30. Right? And when oxygen is not present, only when glycolysis is working, how many ATP are being produced? Can you remember? Okay, for every glucose, remember to get glycolysis started, you need 2 ATP. Glycolysis makes 4 total, but you got to repay that first 2, so glycolysis only makes 2 ATP. So what's better for you? Just operating anaerobically, making 2 ATP for every glucose, or aerobically making 30-something ATP for every glucose molecule? Aerobic respiration is much more efficient. It gives you a lot more ATP. All right, so one way maybe you can think of this is, let's just say you have 2 gas stations. All right, here's gas station A, here's gas station B. They don't sell the same kind of gasoline. The price per gallon is going to be the same. What's the price per gallon? It's dropping a little bit, but let's just say $5. $5 per gallon. Right? Gas station A, when you buy that gasoline, you can go 30 miles per gallon. And gas station B over here, you can only go 2 miles on a gallon of gasoline. What gas station are you going to go to? Yeah, for sure the A, right? For the same dollar amount, you can go almost more than 10 times as far, right? So aerobic respiration is wonderful that way. But what organelle do you need for oxidative phosphorylation, for aerobic respiration. You need that mitochondria. That's why we say mitochondria is the, what you probably learned at a lower level class, is what it's the powerhouse inside the cell, because it makes ATP for us under aerobic conditions. Okay, so there is some discussion how many ATPs are produced via aerobic respiration or anaerobic, and in the book you might see 30, you might see 32, you might see 36 or 38, but the important number is what? 2 or 30 something for aerobic respiration for every glucose. 30 something. I'm not too particular if you know if it's 30 and a half or 31 or 33 and 3 quarters or any of that. Right, it's just 30 something versus 2. Okay, so basically that's what this slide is all about. Just remember, for every NADH in the mitochondria, it produces 3 ATP. For every FADH2, it produces 2 ATP. Right, and you can count how many that is for every glucose for just the electron transport chain. So we get 26 20 ATP through the electron transport chain for every glucose, not for pyruvate, but for glucose, 2 from glycolysis, right? 2 from the Krebs cycle, because the Krebs cycle has to go 2 turns for every glucose. Right? And so if we add all that up, that's about 30 ATPs for every glucose molecule. When I look at these lines right here, 26 ATP producing electron transport, is that substrate level phosphorylation or oxidative phosphorylation? Oxidative phosphorylation, right? Whenever you have transfer of electrons making ATP for you, that is oxidative phosphorylation, because oxygen has to accept those electrons. What about ATP made by glycolysis? Is that oxidative or substrate level phosphorylation? That's just substrate level phosphorylation, right? What about in the Krebs cycle, when that one GTP is made, is that oxidative phosphorylation or direct? That's direct. What's another name for direct phosphorylation? Substrate level, because it's just those substrates for that reaction that participate in making that ATP. It's not a transfer of electrons through an electron transport chain. All right, so those are two main ways. This table right here just kind of reiterates where we get ATPs from. The funny thing about this table that I don't like is that, okay, they have derated how many ATPs are produced for every FADH2 and NADH. Right? It's fine with me if instead of putting 1.5 ATP for every FADH2, what would you want to put there? You want to put there 2, right? Because that corresponds with that diagram. Which diagram? This one right here, right? FADH2, NADH is 3, and so you can substitute that in this table. So for every NADH, you produce 3 instead of 2.5. And that changes the output a little bit, but you're still going to end up with, what, 30-something ATP versus a measly 2 for anaerobic respiration. That's the important point that you should be aware of. Okay, fat and protein metabolism is our next topic. But before we move on to this next topic, who's got a question? Anybody come up with a question regarding respiration so far? No questions for me? Aha, well, I got a question for you then. And let's go back to that very first slide. Okay, here's that very first slide. I will want you to memorize the slide. I want you to be able to draw it next week in lab, and I'll send out an email describing that. All right, so, oops, what happened? Where are we? The tab right here. Okay, so here's that slide. And so what's the purpose of this metabolism? Is it to produce CO2? Is it to produce lactic acid? All right, and this thing here needs oxygen. Is it to get rid of oxygen in our body? No, is it to get rid of glucose because the system is getting rid of glucose? No. What is the purpose of all this metabolism that's not on this slide, and you just got to really be familiar and know what it is? And it is why? It is what? The production of ATP, right? And so all these reactions right here are exorganic reactions, and that energy can be used to make ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate, which is an endergonic reaction, right? Making ATP is endergonic. It has to be coupled with these exorganic reactions in order for it to happen. Okay, there are some other little modifications to this diagram that we talked about. Maybe make sure, oh yeah, like we put a 2 here for pyruvic acid, things like that. Oh, what comes out of the Krebs cycle besides FADH2 and NADH and that one GTP? There's something else that comes out of the Krebs cycle. Okay? CO2. Yeah, well, we have to breathe out of our body, right? And where does that happen? Mitochondria. Krebs cycle is in what organelle? The mitochondria. Where does glycolysis take place? In the cytosol, right? So that's why this illustration is really, really good for you. Okay, now any questions? Nope, okay. Just remember these 4 different compartments and what's happening in them. Okay, lactic acid pathway. All right. Fat and protein metabolism. I think we have time to talk about fat metabolism, probably not so much protein metabolism, maybe just a couple comments on that. So, fats and proteins are large molecules. They can be broken down. And when they're broken down, what else happens when they're broken down? Is that catabolism or anabolism when they're broken down? That's catabolism. What else is produced when something is catabolized? Energy. Yeah, energy. And remember, energy can be converted from one form to another. It can't be used up. So when something is hydrolyzed as a catabolic reaction, it releases energy. And when I say fat, I want you to think of a triglyceride. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Yeah, glycerol and 3 fatty acids, right? And through a dehydration synthesis reaction, you take those 3 fatty acids, put it on glycerol. And if you take the 3 fatty acids off of glycerol, that's not a dehydration synthesis. It's called a, what kind of reaction? When you take a triglyceride apart, that's a hydrolysis reaction, right? Okay, but nonetheless, you end up with glycerol and some fatty acids. All right, the enzyme that breaks a triglyceride down into the building blocks is what we call a lipase. That's a lipase. Proteins can be broken down sort of similarly, but a protein is made up of amino acids, and amino acid has a side group, or it has a residue on it that's different than a fatty acid or glycerol. It has something different than sugars and lipids, okay, and that is an amino group. And when an amino acid is broken down, produces amino groups, it produces something called uric acid that's very toxic, right? So when you break proteins down, there are other metabolic burdens that are placed on somebody. So these amino acids have to be deaminated, and then what's left over can be donated to the Krebs cycle to make ATP or NADH or FADH2. And these different pathways can be used to interconvert carbohydrates into fats, carbohydrates into some kinds of proteins or some kinds of amino acids. Some amino acids can be converted into carbohydrates, but here is something that's a little misleading in this statement. Can a fat ever be converted back into a carbohydrate? Carbohydrate certainly can make fat, but can a fat make a carbohydrate? And the answer is definitely not, okay? So, and as a matter of fact, a fat can't be used to make a protein. So when something is a fat, guess what? It is always a fat. And so let's see what can happen. Your body can use fat as an energy source, but it can't be used to make a carbohydrate or a protein. All right, so how does this happen? So here we have a fat, and what kind of fat would you want to draw in? Let's label this fat right here. I don't want to say prostaglandin. I don't want to say cholesterol. I want you to say triglyceride. Yeah, triglyceride, right? So you got glycerol and 3 fatty acids right here. And so certainly it can be broken down into glycerol and fatty acids, right? And this pathway happens due to lipolysis, and the enzyme is a lipase. Right? So lipolysis, lipase, takes a triglyceride, breaks it down. All right, glycerol has three carbons, like you're aware of, and it can be shuttled over into glycolysis, right? And it can be used to make new glucose, gluconeogenesis, or it can continue down through glycolysis to make pyruvic acid. And then under aerobic conditions, you know what pyruvic acid can produce, right? So a lot of ATP. So glycerol is important. It's a nice storage form of energy and fat. But you have these fatty acids as well. And these are really long chain. They don't have six carbons. They have many. They can have 10 or 20 different carbons in them. So there's a lot more energy associated with a fatty acid compared to a glucose molecule because it has more carbon atoms. The way a fatty acid is broken down for energy, right, is two carbons at a time. So you have a big, long fatty acid molecule. Maybe you have a picture from your first exam of what a fatty acid looks like, a saturated fatty acid, unsaturated fatty acid. Right? It's broken down from the carboxyl and two carbons at a time. And you know what that two-carbon fragment is called. What is that two-carbon fragment called? After the preparatory reaction, you have coenzyme A with an acetyl group. Remember, acetyl coenzyme A, so that two-carbon fragment is an acetyl group. So fatty acids can produce many acetyl CoAs, and that acetyl group can be donated to the Krebs cycle, and you can get ATP and reduced NAD and FADH that can run through electron transport to make a lot of ATP. Okay. So we see that pyruvic acid has three carbons. All of these molecules here either have three or six carbons, like glucose has six, right? So these intermediates can go down, and we call that the forward direction in glycolysis, or they can go back up, the reverse direction of glycolysis. And you should know what these, too bad I don't know these colors, but these look blue over here. What would you call all these blue arrows going down? What metabolic pathway is that? You know what it is. You're just not reading my mind quite right yet. That is glycolysis, right? The breaking down of glucose into pyruvic acid, that's glycolysis. But if we go back the other way and up to here, now those sort of look like green arrows to me, but they're dotted, all right? What do you call all these dotted arrows going up or green? What color is it, green? Orange. Who knows, huh? I'm not the only colorblind person. I'm aware of that. Okay, so the dotted line arrows, what would you call that metabolic pathway? It's making glucose from something that's not glucose. It's making new glucose. We call that what? Gluconeogenesis. So the downward arrows are glycolysis. The upward arrows are gluconeogenesis. And let's look at pyruvic acid. Do we see an upward and a downward arrow from pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA? Do you see two ways or one way? One way. And which way does that go? It only goes from pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA. And because of this step right here, acetyl-CoA can never become a sugar molecule because there's only two carbons. A two-carbon molecule can never be used in our body to make a sugar molecule. And some people use that fact. Interesting. We'll talk maybe about an Atkins diet in just a little bit. All right, but this acetyl-CoA has two possible fates. One fate, it can go into Krebs cycle and then be what? Converted into carbon dioxide and you generate energy. What is another fate for acetyl-CoA? Besides going down, what can it do? It can go over to the left and it can be used to make a fatty acid, which can be used to make a fat. Right? So any two-carbon molecule in your body can be used to make a fat or can be used for energy, and that's it. Can't be used to make a protein or amino acid, can't be used to make a sugar molecule because that two-carbon group, right, just can't be used to make a sugar molecule. It can't go from a two-carbon to a three-carbon group. Other animals can, but humans can't. Okay. The other thing that I see on this diagram, the Krebs cycle, here I see some intermediates like alpha-ketoglutarate, and other kinds of things, oxaloacetic acid. These things are just modifications of sugar molecules. So in order for the Krebs cycle to work, there has to be sugar available in your body to make all of these different intermediates. If you don't have sugar in your body, then the Krebs cycle can't operate. And so what does that mean, if the Krebs cycle can't operate, if you don't have a little bit of sugar in your body? What's the purpose of Krebs cycle? Produce ATP, high energy electrons for electron transport chain. If you don't have sugars in your diet, then that part of your metabolism is shut down, and you can only make ATP via glycolysis. Right? And so what happens then is that fats are converted into this acetyl group, but it can't get into the Krebs cycle when you're starving for glucose, when glucose can't get into the cell, you don't have glucose in your body. This acetyl-CoA can be combined with another acetyl group, making a 4-carbon, and we call those things ketone bodies. So when we don't have sugar in our cells, it makes ketone bodies. And a good example of a ketone body would be acetone. And acetone is highly volatile. So if you have fingernail polish, that's acetone. And if you pour some on the table, what happens to that fingernail polish remover? It evaporates. Does it take days? No, it happens very quickly, right? So when your body is producing a compound like acetone, it's very easy to breathe that right out of your body because it's just a vapor and you breathe it out of your body. And so that's why sometimes when somebody has uncontrolled diabetes, they have that scent on their breath because they are excreting ketone bodies which come from this acetyl group. And that's kind of the basis of the Atkins diet. It's kind of gone by the wayside, and one of these days we'll have some students that have never heard of it. But has anybody heard of Atkins diet in here? Probably it's still fairly common. Well, what is the Atkins diet? It restricts what? Proteins or lipids or carbohydrates? What does it restrict? Carbohydrates. And the Atkins diet says you can eat as many proteins and lipids as you want, okay? But why does it work? Well, because when you don't eat carbohydrates, it shuts down the Krebs cycle and ETC, and you're eating a lot of fats. Those get broken down into acetyl-CoA, and then that gets combined into make something like acetone. So what happens to all that fat that you're eating, all that fat that's in your body? It gets converted into acetone, and what do? You just breathe it right out of your body. That's amazing. Because usually, what do you think about, what's a method for getting rid of adipose tissue on somebody? Is severe exercise, right? So what's easier, breathing or severe exercise? Well, everybody knows the answer to that. So Atkins diet is pretty popular because you can just by breathing, you can lose weight. But what's the side effect? The side effect is, you don't have energy. You're not making ATP. What organs need a lot of ATP? We said brain, kidney, heart, okay? Let's just focus on the brain. If your brain doesn't have ATP, you lose brain function. And as a matter of fact, people that are on an Atkins diet, if they don't follow it precisely, their brain is not functioning. You'll find them driving on the wrong side of a road, okay? They'll look at a stoplight and not know that that has different colors, right? And it can drive right through a stoplight. So would you like to be on an Atkins diet and take microbiology or physiology class at the same time? No, because you won't have proper brain function, right? So please don't get on a strange diet like that when you really need a lot of brain function. So Atkins diet can be very dangerous unless you're working with a dietitian or a physician or somebody that knows some of these intricate details of the biochemistry that's involved. So biochemistry, you guys, can be really fun to know about that stuff, right? And why is that Atkins diet useful? Because these 2-carbon groups can't be used to make sugar. That's the basic reason why. Okay. So this slide is pretty good because I don't see acetyl-CoA being used to make a sugar molecule. That's really good, but it can be used to make ketone bodies, right? Like acetone, for instance, can be used to make cholesterol, can be used to make fatty acids, and can be used to make citric acid only if there are carbohydrates. So you might want to cross this off, right, and just put down here, acetyl-CoA can go into Krebs cycle only when you have sugars in your diet, no sugars in your diet, this thing goes away. All that ATP that's produced oxidatively can't happen in your body. The other sort of interesting thing is, what's another condition where you don't have glucose inside your cells? You have high glucose in your blood, but the glucose in your blood can't even get into your cells. What's that condition called? Everybody knows what it is. Yeah, that's diabetes mellitus. So the Atkins diet is almost like producing an artificial form of diabetes mellitus in people, because the bottom line is cells don't have glucose for metabolism. So that's an interesting connection. Okay. Fat synthesis, call that lipogenesis. You know that to be what a dehydration synthesis reaction, taking three fatty acids, glycerol, to make a triglyceride. All right, what's the reverse of that called? Taking a triglyceride and making fatty acids and glycerol out of it, that is lipolysis. Yeah, lipolysis, because we're going to look at something else called beta oxidation, and I want you to understand what the distinction is. Fats are a major form of energy in your body. They yield for 1 gram, so that's a weight, just a certain amount, a certain weight of lipid, right? 1 gram contains 9 kilocalories. A calorie is a measure of energy or a measure of heat. And I want you to be able to compare that with how much energy is in a carbohydrate and a protein. They're basically the same. Carbohydrate and protein only have 4 kilocalories for every gram. So for the same weight, same amount, there is what? More than twice the amount of energy in a lipid compared to a sugar and a protein. So another way to consider or work with weight control is to not eat compounds that have a high caloric content to them. Right? So, and this sort of goes against the Atkins diet, because that says carbohydrates and proteins are good. You'd want to restrict what from your diet? Fats, because there's so much energy associated with fats. So that's one way to maintain weight. Okay, lipolysis. Ooh, what did we say lipolysis was? The breakdown of triglyceride. Okay, and so now we have fatty acids, right? Lipase or lipolysis makes fatty acids. How do we get the energy out of fatty acids? We have to catabolize a fatty acid. That process is not called lipolysis, even though you consider a fatty acid a lipid, right? That's what we're going to call beta oxidation. So beta oxidation will break down a fatty acid into those acetyl groups. And then those acetyl groups can go into the Krebs cycle, as long as you have sugars in your diet, and you can make a lot of ATP that way. Okay, let's look at beta oxidation. So beta oxidation works on what kind of molecule? It's a fatty acid, right? It's a fatty acid. So here we have, right, a fatty acid. It's not all drawn out, because you'd have to have many, many carbons, right? But the one terminus of that fatty acid, we have a carboxyl group. That's the reactive end of this fatty acid. The carbon right next to the carboxyl group is called the alpha carbon. The carbon that is next to the alpha is called the beta carbon. So here's the beta carbon. And so that's where beta oxidation gets its name from, because there's something special that happens between this alpha and beta carbon in a fatty acid. And that's where there is a cleavage that happens, and that produces this acetyl group. All right, so to get beta oxidation started, what about ATP? Is it consumed or is it produced? It's consumed, right? So beta oxidation is consuming ATP, but that's kind of the reverse of what we want to do. We want to make ATP. But this is very similar to another process that we've looked at already. What important metabolic reaction that eventually ends up to be exergonic requires ATP just to get started? Which was glycolysis. Glycolysis. Remember, 2 ATPs have to be used up to get glycolysis started, and then when glycolysis starts, remember that? Oh, close your eyes. I'm going to flip back way back over here. Don't get sick. All right? Right here. Here's glycolysis, right? Because here's glucose, here's pyruvic acid, it's exergonic, but in order to get glycolysis started, you need what? ATPs, you need two ATPs. Why do you need these ATPs? What do we call this barrier? This is the activation energy barrier. Same thing for beta oxidation, not two ATPs, but just one. Okay, that we see right here. Okay, and when ATP is used, a coenzyme A then is added to the carboxyl group, and then there's some oxidation reduction reactions that take place. In this first step, an FAD is converted into an FADH2. And what can you tell me about FADH2? Is it good for anything? It can make ATP. And remember, too, I don't care if you know it to be 1.5 or 1.75, just say 2. All right, and then there's some other reactions that take place, some other steps, and then through this process, an NAD plus is converted into an NADH, and what good is NADH? It can donate electrons to ETC, producing a lot of ATP. How many ATPs? Namely, 3 ATPs. It says 2 on this diagram. I don't care. You can say 2.5 or 3. That puts you in the ballpark. And then what happens? Okay, what do we have? We have a decarboxylation someplace. Where's CO2 released? Oh, no. It's here. It's not a decarboxylation. It's this acetyl group bound to this acetyl-CoA is cleaved right here, right? And in that process, another acetyl-CoA is added to this carbon, and you end up back at this location. And don't forget, this acetyl-CoA can then join the Krebs cycle and produce a lot of ATP, right? Because all the NADs and FADH2s in the Krebs cycle are donated to electron transport. And this happens, right, two carbon atoms at a time. So only the first step requires one ATP. So for a 20-carbon amino acid, right, this has to happen, what, 10 times. It has to go through this 10 times, and so you'll get 20 acetyl-CoAs produced that go through the rest of aerobic respiration to make ATP. And so just that one fatty acid has a tremendous amount of energy in it because of beta oxidation. Okay, and where is beta oxidation? Well, it requires Krebs and electron transport. It is inside mitochondria. Beta oxidation only happens under aerobic conditions. And that tells you that right here in the name. All right, so beta oxidation. If you want to think of beta oxidation, what's a good way to talk about it? What good is beta oxidation for you? What does it do? It breaks down fatty acids. Does beta oxidation break down a triglyceride? Okay. Beta oxidation breaks down a fatty acid, but how do you break down a triglyceride? That is with lipolysis and a lipase, right? So the breakdown of a triglyceride is different than beta oxidation. Beta oxidation breaks down a fatty acid. Lipolysis breaks down a lipid like a triglyceride. So there's like two different sets of reactions there. All right, and the one that makes ATP for us is beta oxidation that happens inside mitochondria under aerobic conditions. So you got some questions at the end of the chapter regarding lipolysis and beta oxidation. Remember, there's two different locations where that happens. Beta oxidation, depending on the length of this hydrocarbon right here, beta oxidation, without considering Krebs cycle, it would give us, for every two carbon, it would give us 2 plus 3, it would give us 4. But if you want to use 1.5 and 2.5, then yeah, you could say 4. So somewhere between 4 and 5, depending on how ideal the conditions are. But don't forget, these acetyl-CoAs still can generate ATP for us via the Krebs cycle and electron transport chain. Yeah, question. Proteins can turn into fats. When you're at a high energy level, when you have plenty of ATP, then proteins can be converted into a fat, but it has to be deaminated first. That amino group has to be taken off of an amino acid, and then that amino group has to be converted into, it's very toxic, it has to be converted into something that you can excrete from your body. It has to be converted into urea. But yeah, there's that one additional step, deamination, and then the leftover carbons can be used to make sugar. As long as there are other sugars in your body to maintain the Krebs cycle. Without sugars in your body, proteins can't be used to make sugar. But with other sugars in your body, it can. Kind of strange concept. Okay. So only if you have sugars in your diet can a protein be used to make other sugars. But with no sugars in your body can't make sugar from protein. It can. Yep. Proteins can be converted into fat pretty easily. Okay. Okay, what contains more energy? The animation to make sure that some of these concepts you become familiar with.